Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and discuss the Arab Spring and its aftermath in Egypt and Libya with Sama Shahata, Professor of Arab Politics at Georgetown University, who has recently returned from Egypt. Then we'll look into the extraordinary overreaction to the boneheaded provocations of an obscure media-hungry Florida pastor's burning of the Quran. A former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who was a friend of one of the women butchered by the rampaging mob, Christine Fair, joins us. She is a professor in peace and security studies at Georgetown University. Then finally, we'll talk with the real Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Robert and Dana Baer, authors of a new book, The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife's True Life Spy Story. George Clooney won an Academy Award for portraying Robert Baer in the movie Syriana, which was based on Baer's book, See No Evil. Robert Baer met his wife, Dana, who was a CIA shooter assigned to protect him in Sarajevo during the Bosnian War. Let's now start with a discussion on Egypt and Libya. Joining us now is Sama Shahata, who is a professor at the Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He's the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sama Shahata.
Thank you.
And clearly there has been lots of reports from the PBS Frontline series. The New York Times did a series of articles as well on the notion that this youth-driven, largely middle-class rebellion in Egypt that we all witnessed is slowly being captured by the Muslim Brotherhood, who have made some unholy alliance with the Egyptian military, who are very much in control of the country. What, since you've just returned from Egypt recently, what's your sense of that analysis?
Well, I think that analysis is exaggerated to a significant extent. There's no question that the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist forces have awoken in Egypt in a new environment. I mean, in the past, of course, under the Mubarak regime, they faced significant repression that could mean arbitrary detention, arrests, prison time, and, of course, harassment at the time of election, including fraudulent election results. This is, of course, a new period for groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, who are the most organized and possibly the largest opposition group. So clearly, they are ecstatic at the new found freedoms that they have, and there is some fear, of course, among secular parties and individuals and others that they will become increasingly powerful. But I think it would be mistaken to say that they have entered some kind of an alliance with the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, or that some kind of a deal has been made and that they're poised to take over the country. There's very little evidence of that, in fact. I can understand the fears that people might have, some of the fears, as it were, but I'm actually much more optimistic. And I think that in addition to the newfound freedoms that groups like the Muslim Brotherhood are enjoying, I think other groups certainly are going to emerge that are going to represent different political ideas. And moreover, we've already seen some fragmentation within the Muslim Brotherhood. We've seen the emergence of other groups on the left and on the right that is more progressive and more conservative than the Muslim Brotherhood, who are going to compete among each other for votes and so on. So I think it would be overstating the fact to say that the Muslim Brotherhood now is poised to take over the revolution, or that they have made some kind of an alliance with the Supreme Military Council and things are moving in a particular direction.
But the Supreme Military Council, who are very much in control, there was some indications in the referendum, that the recent referendum that got, 77% of the vote, that many of the leaders of the revolution in Tahrir Square were opposed to it, and for the reasons that we've just discussed, the notion that they may be aced out of power. What's your analysis of that?
Well, you know, I was there at the time of the significant discussion and heated debate before the referendum, and certainly you're correct that most progressive intellectuals, those who are active in politics, who are secular. In fact, I think it also coincided with whether one was kind of urban, upper middle class, and so on, voted against the constitutional amendments, and for some good reasons. At the same time, however, I think it would also be mistaken to attribute the 77.2% of the voters who voted yes for the constitutional amendments to attribute that high percentage to Muslim Brotherhood support. Certainly the Muslim Brotherhood supported the amendments, and there was also, unfortunately, some misinformation and use of religion to entice people, not necessarily by the Muslim Brotherhood, but by others, to vote yes for the constitutional amendments. But I think that the vast majority of Egyptians felt, and I disagree with this, I would have voted if I was in the country against the constitutional amendments, but I don't think it's that important. The most of the people voted yes for the constitutional amendments because they felt they were sufficient to move forward at this particular time to move to an elected parliament and an elected president. And there's no indication that that's not going to move forward as scheduled. In fact, one of the fears that people who voted against the constitutional amendments, that is holding elections too early in June, as was previously announced for parliament, and August for president, that has been delayed. So at least partially that concern has been addressed. And now we are told by the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces that parliamentary elections are going to be held in September and presidential elections are going to be held somewhat after that, giving new groups, giving opposition parties, secular parties, and so on, a little bit more time to organize.
Again, I'm speaking with Samer Shahata, who is a professor of Arab politics at Georgetown University, and we're talking about the day-after scenarios of the Arab Spring in Egypt in particular, but we'll also move to Libya in a moment, since Libya, the composition of the opposition in Libya has always been a question, and similar objections to the Islamists in Egypt are being expressed, of course, by Gaddafi and others, including Glenn Beck. It's interesting to see Glenn Beck and Gaddafi on the same page, Samer Shahata.
Yes. I mean, if I could just say one other thing about the referendum. I think the most important thing that took place on March 19th with regards to the referendum and the 77.2% of the people who voted yes for the referendum isn't that the referendum passed or that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood supported it, but the fact that this was the first time in Egypt's modern history that there were relatively, or to a large extent, elections with integrity, where people's votes counted, that were not marred by systematic irregularities, violence, vote fraud, ballot stuffing, and so on. I mean, this Egyptian elections under the Mubarak regime were characterized by violence, regular fraud, the things that was certain about Egyptian elections, that they were not free and fair. So the fact that people stood in long lines, that there was a relatively high percentage of people who participated, that there were not significant incidences of violence, that no one died, that people actually felt their votes counted, I think that's the most important thing to take away from the March 19th referendum. With regard to the question of Islamists and Glenn Beck, you're completely correct that many people on the right in the United States are hysterical about the potential for Islamists to come to power in places like Egypt and Libya. I mean, it is the case, of course, that there is some opacity with regard to who the Libyan rebels are. There's no question that they are made up of a variety of individuals, middle-class professionals, youth, some people who clearly believe in the principles of democracy and freedom. And of course, there are also Islamists of different varieties, including some radical Islamists. There's some evidence that some people, Libyans who have returned from Iraq and elsewhere as fighters or jihadis. But I don't think it would be accurate to say that that's the majority of the opposition. I think anyone who's familiar with Libyan politics and Mr. Gaddafi's depraved autocratic regime realizes that the vast majority of Libyans are against Mr. Gaddafi, and that includes people who have no political ideas, people who are Democrats, who are liberal, who are socially conservative, and so on. And I think it's also important to understand that to a large extent, these are conservative societies. Libya may be particularly so compared with a country like Tunisia on its border, or even Egypt. And that means that there's going to be a great deal of religiosity, of belief that Islam should play some role in politics among a wide variety of people. And that in itself is not necessarily threatening to democracy or basic rights.
So, Sami Shahada, just before we move on to discuss Libya and Egypt's role or covert role of the military, Egypt's military in Libya, one bit of news, Al Jazeera is reporting that Mubarak, the former dictator, has flown out of Egypt for medical treatment in Germany. And is that likely to affect the trials? I mean, there may be some backlash from people who feel, because I understand that a lot of Mubarak's cronies are they're going to be tried. I mean, there's some serious truth and reconciliation going on.
Yes, well, let's hope that's the case. In fact, that's something that much more so than the Islamists that I have been fearful of, and that is the lack of forward progress on criminally prosecuting many people in the Mubarak regime. I mean, there were a number of individuals, including the head of the National Democratic Party, a despised figure, Safwat al-Sharif, Zakaria Azmi, another presidential advisor who was working in the office of the president and a minister, the Speaker of Parliament, Fethi Sroor, all leading cronies in the Mubarak regime who up until recently, and in fact still, are free, are allowed to do their business. One of them is still going to work. And so the fear that I have had, and I think many in Egypt have, is that the revolution isn't moving fast enough, that there are some real concerns that the Supreme Military Council are not or don't share fully the views of the millions of people who wanted regime change, who wanted a fundamentally different kind of politics, and that these people, some of them have been put on lists that do not allow them to leave the country. Others are under investigation for different kinds of fraud. A few individuals have been detained, a number of former ministers, and are in jail awaiting trial, including the ex-minister of the Interior. But the concerns that the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces is not completely on the same page as the millions of people who wanted and not only the downfall of Mubarak, but a fundamentally different type of politics in Egypt, that's the concern that I have. With regard to Mubarak's leaving, there have been rumors, of course, in the past that Mubarak left to Saudi Arabia, that he and his family, members of his family, went to England and so on, and none of these are confirmed. Of course, it would make sense because the basic demand that is that Mubarak also be held accountable for the deaths that took place between January 25th and February 11th when he finally was removed from power. Over 300 people, civilians, were killed in those protests by the regime's security forces, by thugs, by the use of live ammunition, and so on. And of course, the illicit wealth, tremendous amounts that we've heard, varying from a few billion dollars to upwards of $40 billion stolen by the Mubarak family. So there have been calls that they need to be tried, that they need to be held accountable, and of course it would make sense that they would want to leave the country. It's known that the president's wife and at least one of his sons, Gamal Mubarak, and his family have a British citizenship and that they own property there, and there were rumors that they had at least left the country earlier, but none of these are confirmed.
So, Sami Shahada, let's turn to Libya. Now, there are reports that the Libyan rebels are getting military equipment and training from the Egyptian military, perhaps some of it covert. What's your understanding of that?
Well, again, there have been some reports, in fact, from several weeks ago, earlier than more recently, than the more recent discussion of the possibility of Western countries supporting, training, providing weapons to the Libyan rebels. There were reports in the Arabic press several weeks ago that some kinds of arms shipments and so on were taking place over the Egyptian border. Now, it would make sense that, of course, the rebels would try to procure arms either with the knowledge of the Egyptian military or without the knowledge over that border. It's a somewhat porous border. It's also quite reasonable to expect that the Egyptian military doesn't want this to be, and the Egyptian government doesn't want this to be something that is known. As you know, there are hundreds of thousands of Egyptians who are still in Libya, who have been working there, who are resident there, and so on. And of course, they would be prone to attacks or reprisals by Gaddafi's forces. And it's also true that I think the United States government, as well as the government of France and Britain, would want to, and have basically stated as much, to arm the rebels. And of course, it would be easier to arm them through a third party like Egypt or Saudi Arabia than it would to do so directly for legal and for political reasons and so on. So it's not surprising to me. Also, in the last week, of course, we've learned through reporting that President Obama has signed a directive that allows CIA operatives inside Libya to gather evidence and possibly to support the rebels. And of course, there's a public discussion now in this country and in other countries about the legality of that, considering that Resolution 1970 places an arms embargo on Libya. And of course, there have been officials like Secretary Clinton and others who have argued that it would be legal to arm the rebels, because 1973 UN Security Council resolution supersedes that and states that they should, that, you know, protecting civilians by all means necessary. So it wouldn't be surprising to me at all if the rebels were being armed by Western governments as well as by intermediaries such as the Egyptian armed forces, the Saudis, and others.
Well, Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, said in response to a question of whether the United States is arming the rebels or intends to do so, he said, no, we're not going to do that. We'll let others do it. And that my impression was that perhaps that meant Egypt. And just in general, though, it would seem that given the nature of this very much ad hoc citizens army, I mean, how often do you see people going off to war in jeans and T-shirts? And they clearly, the rebels clearly don't have the same kind of military discipline, training, and equipment that Gaddafi has. So somebody has to be organizing this mob, which has been described as a kind of Mad Max army.
Well, yes, and I think that's clearly one of the shortcomings of the rebels, the lack of training, the lack of discipline, and so on. And that, of course, accounts to some extent for their losses of territory over the last 3 days, despite the fact that in the period immediately after the commencement of bombing of Gaddafi's forces, they made tremendous progress. So, yes, I mean, that's clearly one of their deficits, one of their shortcomings, and there's talk of the necessity of actually not only supplying them weapons, but training them with regard to how to use these weapons against Gaddafi's forces. All of this, of course, means that the fighting in Libya is likely to continue for some time and not to end in the immediate days to come, unlike what many people have predicted.
Well, just in closing, though, there is a steady defection of high-level officials from Gaddafi's regime, not just the former intelligence chief, Moussa Koussa, but now his deputies just fled to Egypt, too, the deputy foreign minister. So presumably there's some useful intelligence on, mostly on Gaddafi and who's running the show, him and his sons, one of whom I believe has already been killed by an airstrike, the head of the 32nd Brigade.
Right. It's been reported that. I mean, you know, and let me be clear. The Gaddafi regime is a terrible regime, you know, that has systematically used torture, assassination, and repression against its population for the last 40 years. And in fact, I supported some kind of intervention. I hope that it would be a kind of Arab-led intervention with regards to Libya. But the situation is difficult. It's certainly messy. And the sooner that Mr. Gaddafi is removed from power, I think the better for Libya and the region. Because, of course, what is at stake is not only the future of Libya, but I think the future of Tunisia and Egypt, neighboring countries, as well as what Gaddafi remaining in power might mean for other citizens in other states, whether it be Syria or Yemen and so on, and their desires and movement for freedom in the future. So a lot is at stake here.
I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Samer Shahata.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Samer Shahata, who is a professor at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. He's the author of Shop Floor Culture and Politics in Egypt. We'll take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a friend of one of the UN women who were butchered by the rampaging mob in response to this idiot down in Florida burning the Koran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer. She's a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include Treading Softly on Sacred Ground, Counterinsurgency Operations in Sacred Space, The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, the Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you.
And Chris, you were there in Afghanistan as a United Nations political officer, and I take it that one of the women that you worked with was one of the victims of this atrocious attack in Masjid Sharif.
No. I mean, actually, the station, the person that was the head of office, of course, I've known. I mean, there's a lot of churn in UNAMA. And they haven't made clear who all the folks are, but I did very casually know the head of office there.
And the Russian in charge of the office, of course,
exactly.
He pretended. This is the fellow you knew?
Well, I mean, a lot of these folks have been around for a while. As I said, you know, he had actually been there for a while when I was there in 07. I'm pretty sure he was there.
And he's escaped because he speaks Dari and was able to say that he was a Muslim.
That has been reported, but I obviously have no insight into that.
So, in general, what is your impression then that this obscure, media-hungry pastor down in Florida is able to create such a overreaction in another part of the world?
Well, first of all, he did not create this overreaction. And I have to say, it's pretty difficult for me to have a rational discussion about this because, quite frankly, I'm really angry about it. It's above the fact that this pastor is a complete lunatic from the boondocks of Florida who enjoys very little support. I mean, most Americans generally, are absolutely appalled that this individual is doing this. I actually put the blame, quite frankly, on President Karzai. President Karzai has been consistently whipping up a domestic frenzy about this issue in Afghanistan. His most recent musings that the Americans have to, quote, bring to justice, unquote. He knows full well that though it may be loathsome that Pastor Jones has burned the Quran, he knows that he hasn't violated the law. So for President Karzai to be making these public protestations and demands that he knows are absolutely preposterous has, I would argue, done more to inflame Afghans than anything else. So when I sort of think about where the blame sort of gets spread around, it's really difficult not to be incredibly angry at Karzai himself.
And would that explain then why it seems like everybody in Afghanistan knew about the actions of this obscure pastor down in Florida, but nobody much here in the United States has ever even heard of him?
Well, you know, you have to really ask this question. This is a country wherein approximately 85-90% of the population is illiterate, and yet all of a sudden they seem to be incredibly familiar with activities of an obscure pastor in nowhere, Florida, with a following of 10. And, you know, so apart from holding Karzai deeply responsible for this, there have been a number of religious entrepreneurs in the Muslim world themselves. By the way, this was the case with the Khartoum riots. You know, we saw a very similar drama. Many of the so-called blasphemous cartoons had never actually even been published. But we now know that there were a number of specific, I'm going to call them entrepreneurs, that brought these non-published cartoons to light and generated quite a bit of violence. But the Maulvi at the Blue Mosque itself in Mazar is also responsible for whipping up this this crowd into this frenzy. And there is an absolute irony here. And, it's, as I said, it's difficult for me to not be angry about this because at the end of the day, they're going to be killing Muslims. I mean, look at who was killed in the Mazar attack. Were there any Americans killed in the Mazar attack? But more importantly, the hypocrisy of this. I can't count how many Qurans have been built when Sunni militants go in and burn Shia mosques? Where's the outrage at the innumerable numbers of Qurans that are destroyed due to senseless sectarian violence? So one can focus this around what actually happened to a book considered to be sacred by a community, but there are many more Qurans that have been burnt in sectarian violence than this clown in Florida could even aspire to burn.
Well, I suppose then the question then becomes: is the words on the page of a sacred text more valuable than the lives of human beings?
Well, you know, look, I'm not a Muslim, so I can't speak to that. And you would have to talk to, and of course you're going to find people who have very different views. I mean, from my various acquaintances, for example, on Facebook and Twitter. I mean, we've had some lively exchanges about this, and there's obviously, even within the Muslim world, a lot of outrage that this is actually going on. So there's not a monolithic response by any means. But I think there's what we really are confronting more than anything else is a class of juridical culture. You know, I found some of the musings of my Pakistani acquaintances to be really quite frustrating. I was in Pakistan when Governor Salman Taseer was killed because he had the hubris to note that Pakistan's blasphemy law itself is discordant with the evidentiary standards in the Quran. I was there when he was killed. Incredibly sensible people had no problem with his being killed. Large crowds thronged various sites of congregation to celebrate the actions of his killer. And so it's so bizarre to me that you would have a legal environment that doesn't allow basic things like freedom of speech to the exclusion of basically lionizing murderers. And then you also have these demands that this fellow, you know, be quote, brought to justice for burning the Quran. I think it's just very difficult for Americans to understand, and I think it's very difficult for people in the region to understand. We are really in a class of juridical cultures, and I don't see an easy way of resolving this. My friends and associates in South Asia don't understand that this nut job's right to burn a Quran is exactly the same rights that allow Muslims, Jews, Christians, atheists like me to believe what we believe or not believe. And so this understanding, this legal commitment to freedom of speech and freedom of faith just has no resonance in many of the areas where we're seeing these kinds of protests. I mean, Afghanistan and Pakistan, they have no culture of this variety. You don't have freedom of religion. If you convert to become a Christian, this is a capital crime. So this is one of those issues where it's almost impossible to have a rational conversation because the fundamental commitments of folks on the various sides of this discussion have very different understandings of rights and responsibilities.
And we're talking about the butchering of UN workers and their Gurkha guards and various uprisings throughout Afghanistan. And I suppose in Pakistan, too, I imagine there's riots as well.
Well, I mean, you've seen the comments already from the president, again, President Zardari, demanding that he, quote, be brought to justice. These guys know full well he's not broken an American law. So this is nothing but fatuous pandering to a population that can be very easily mobilized on these issues. Both President Zardari and President Karzai know he has not broken an American law, so there is no, quote, bringing him to justice. So the man is completely loathsome for burning a Quran. He is apparently entitled to do so under our Constitution. And those very same constitutional provisions are what allow you and me to believe what we believe or not believe. And so would I rather have some individual being allowed to burn a Quran or live in a juridical culture where murderers are in fact celebrated? I don't know. It's fairly easy. It's fairly easy for me to make that choice.
Well, the governor that you referred to, Christopher, he, of course, was murdered because he supported the reform of the blasphemy laws. That some Christian woman was being hung out to dry as a result of these draconian blasphemy laws. So it does.
Well, the blasphemy law in Pakistan is particularly absurd because there's virtually no evidentiary requirements, and it's usually deployed to settle a dispute. So it's you know, and of course, if you actually read the Quran, there are a number, I mean, there's a lot of different controversial things, but one is, for example, a blasphemer has 3 days to repent their blasphemy, in which case they're supposed to be absolved. On another set of controversial issues, it's not even clear that a non-Muslim can be a blasphemer. But in any event, there's evidentiary requirements that the individual be declared a blasphemer. Of course, Pakistan's law requires none of this. And so it's usually used to settle disputes. And of course, it's difficult to get a prosecution. It's very difficult all the way around to deal with blasphemy. If the individual is acquitted, judges are afraid of retribution. If the individual is acquitted, it's not uncommon that they might be gunned down actually in the courthouse premises. If they are committed to jail, which is often the case, or while they're languishing in jail while their case actually comes to trial, it's not unusual for them to be killed while they're in prison. So, you know, this is obviously not something, I think it's difficult for Americans to understand that you can have a system that puts people to death for blasphemy, especially when blasphemy is so capaciously defined under this law and with such little evidentiary requirements. Difficult for us to understand that. But in the same way, it's difficult for Pakistanis to understand how it is that we can let some dude burn the Quran. I mean, this is a clash of juridical cultures. It's fundamental. I don't really see a way of, I don't know how we resolve this.
Well, obviously, it's not wise or responsible to stir up this kind of activity. And what I find more offensive than this boneheaded, media-hungry pastor down there, who also, by the way, is equally active in anti-gay as well as anti-Muslim settlements, he's tied in with...
He's truly a despicable human being. Right. You know, the thing is this, Ian, there's no public support for him.
No, and I was about to say, though, that we have more serious people who are given airtime on Fox, for example, like Glenn Beck, who on a nightly basis attacks Muslims and suggests that our entire foreign policy in the Middle East is misguided because people like Gaddafi and Mubarak are toppling and they're going to be replaced by Sharia law. He had Richard Pipes on the other day, who I believe
Daniel Pipes?
Daniel Pipe, the son of Richard Pipes. The head of USIP. He was on there spouting the same kind of nonsense about the, you know, this kind of Armageddon of Sharia that threatens the West.
Well, and of course, you know, the supreme irony is that when you have a butchery like this, you know, the supreme irony is that these sorts of savage attacks actually fuel the very fires of hatred that this idiot pastor himself sought to stoke in the first instance. And when it's all said and done, Ian, there's going to be a lot more Muslims killed as a consequence of this than non-Muslims. I mean, how many Afghans themselves were killed in the Mazar-e-Sharif attack?
Well, I suppose the other question that we're left with just in the last couple of minutes, Chris Fair, is that we are in the midst of this nation-building effort here in Afghanistan that's costing the U.S. taxpayer something like $8 billion a month. And a lot of Americans have to be asking themselves, you know, are we really going to impose our values or encourage our values on people who have clearly very different outlooks than we do?
Well, look, I mean, this is another issue about which I have very firm feelings. If there's some genuine expectation that is a result of our presence in Afghanistan, that we're somehow going to change Afghan culture, and this is already misguided. So, and I get very frustrated when I hear people talk about, well, if we leave Afghanistan, women will have no rights. Well, as evidenced by these rampages, very few people have rights in Afghanistan, very fundamental rights of safety people don't have in Afghanistan. So if that's some expectation that people have, I think those expectations need to be disabused. What we've been trying to do is try to establish some form of basic governance where the government can provide very basic amenities so that the government can basically outcompete the Taliban. We have failed in every regard to do this. And so I think the question is not about changing Afghan values. I think we have no right to even consider that. But what we do have a requirement to do is ask ourselves, when you have the Afghan president himself opportunistically stoking domestic outrage over the activities of a wackadoon in a Floridian boondocks who is reviled by your average American, you know, stoking this outrage for nothing but political purposes, we have to wonder, what are we doing with an ally like this? And that's, for me, the question that all of this raises. We have spent so many lives, both military, civilian, American, and Afghan, and obviously the endless bleed of treasure, to prop up the government of a man like Karzai, who is so clearly not an ally worth defending. Well, and the irresponsibility of Karzai, there's going to be more Afghans that die as a consequence of this than not. So not only is he imperiling the relationship that he has, or lack thereof, with the American population, he's putting his own population at risk for his own selfish political needs. It's outrageous.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Christine Fair.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan. She's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, and is a senior fellow in study of terrorism at West Point. Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the real lives Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Bob and Dana Bear. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Robert and Dana Bear, who are the authors of a new book, The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. Robert Baer is a veteran CIA operations officer and the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. Dana Bear was also an accomplished CIA operative specializing in protection and surveillance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer and Dana Bear.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ian.
And let me begin with you, Robert, just because in the earlier interview we did with the specialist from Cairo on both Egypt and Libya, there was talk of some covert activity on the part of the CIA in Libya. My understanding is that one of the problems that the CIA has is that all of its Arab-speaking assets are either in Iraq or in Afghanistan. And I'm just wondering, if you were still in the agency, who would they be sending there?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, you know, we've had two wars now that have drawn away people for these deployments that go for 6 months, and no one's got time for language. You don't have time to train Arabists. CIA, 50% of the people have come in since 9/11. It's a figure I haven't confirmed, but I think it's fairly accurate. And who remembers the Libyans? We've forgotten the last 10 years. And, you know, you see these old exiles being sent back, and it's a real dog's breakfast, you know, what's going on in Benghazi. Who's in control? There's a transitional council, but are they really in control? There was fighting yesterday between the military commanders, and apparently this strike on the rebels was caused by disorganization on the side of the Libyans.
And Dana, if you were still in the agency, you mentioned in the book, The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife's True Life Spy Story, is one of your colleagues was one of these people who get whipsawed all the time and sent abroad, and you didn't want that to be your fate.
No, I know. You know, that was eventually one of the reasons that we left, is just because you're gone all the time, and you're working in a different name, and you know there's no phone calls, there's no emails home, and you know that's part of one of the themes of the books, as you know, is just the separation and the alienation that it creates in families.
And in terms of your towards the end of the book, your attempts to adopt an orphan in Pakistan. It sort of reminds me or brings up some of the issues that we were just discussing then with a former UN political officer in Afghanistan over the reaction to the burning of the Quran by an obscure Florida pastor and the double standard in Pakistan, where recently a minister was murdered and his murder was celebrated, whereas the burning of this Quran is causing all of this mayhem. Is that the environment that you're dealing with?
Yeah, I mean, you've got this whole trend in Pakistan, the Deobandis, which are, you know, it's an oversimplification, but they're Wahhabis. And the little girl we adopted is Christian. Her mother had died. and it is a beleaguered community, and they certainly don't have, you know, the right to defend themselves, or they will, you know, just as the ministers, the anti-blasphemy laws that were, he was questioning them. And he was assassinated as well. So it is very much one-sided, but that doesn't forgive this Florida pastor who this was an unnecessary act of hate. It's not Christian at all.
But Dana, in terms of the nail-biting process that you went through there, it does feel that both the Christian community is beleaguered, and that there's this general sense at the last minute when you finally your last barrier is going through the customs at Pakistan with your new child, you know, where he says, "Why didn't you adopt a Muslim child?"
Right, right. You know, it was a harrowing experience, and you know, we had a Pakistani lawyer who we listened to because we didn't know otherwise, and we actually went through an initial guardianship proceeding. And it wasn't until we came out of that proceeding that our lawyer told us that the judge was Taliban. And we had been required to prove our bona fides at that time. And in the only way we knew how to do that, and in fact this was on the advice of the lawyer, was to provide a copy of one of Bob's books. So it immediately became clear to the judge who we were and where we had worked. And, you know, we were denied guardianship at that point. So the whole, yes, it was very precarious. We did succeed on appeal with our lawyer's help, but yes, and then you know you're constantly worried, as we were when we were leaving the airport, and you know, we were being questioned as to our daughter's faith. So yes.
But just to go back to the decision to adopt, let me ask Bob: did you mention in the book that you originally thought of adopting a child from Chechnya, and your Russian KGB contact there sort of said, "Well, I don't know of any orphans, but we can maybe create one for you," which was a
that was, you know, all through this book we try to introduce a little bit of humor. It's a very self-deprecating book, and I did call up the chief of a intelligence service, a KGB officer in the Caucasus, and he said, "Yeah, oh, Mr. Bob, he had a very hard time understanding me exactly what I wanted." And then when I wanted to tell him I wanted to adopt a Chechen, he paused for a while and said, if we can't find orphan, we make orphan for you." And it was his sense of humor. But
Dana, I'm sure the audience wanted to know why you and Bob chose first a Chechen child, and then secondly a child from the Pakistan, Afghanistan
area. We really wanted to adopt from someplace we'd been before, some area of the world where we worked, where we knew people, where we would be likely to go back, where we could bring an adopted child back and hopefully keep her in contact with her culture, relatives, if she had any. So, you know, Chechen, Bob had worked in Azerbaijan, and so that was sort of our first thought, and we narrowed down to Pakistan. I had worked there, and Bob had been there, and it was a place where we found out we could adopt, and we could do it independently, sort of on our own. There's no agencies, no adoption agencies that work there, and that was something else we wanted to do, was we wanted to be hands-on about it.
And you both met when Dana was assigned to you, Bob, as a shooter to protect you in Sarajevo, where you were chasing down a Hezbollah cell who was setting up a shop there. What I find interesting about your book, the new book, The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife's True Life Spy Story, is your grudging admiration for the Iranians of having pulled off a bunch of attacks on the United States in essentially an undeclared war that they've had since 1979, and that basically they've gotten away with it, with all of their attacks on the U.S.
Well, it was, you know, it was more than that. It was the trade craft. I'd been in Beirut in the 80s and had watched these people. They never maintained a fixed base. They never were up on phones. Their addresses were impossible to run down. They were they were a moving target. And moving targets are very hard to hit in this world. So what I wanted to do in Sarajevo, since Hezbollah in Iran was targeting us there,
was to make the CIA people working for me a moving target. You know, they just we changed houses every couple of weeks, cars every week, changed plates, rotated people in and out. So they didn't really have a fixed base. Hezbollah didn't to focus on. You know, this was something completely novel, but it seemed to be the place to do it without, you know, a central state.
It wasn't without cost, though, Dana. One of your colleagues, a female colleague of yours, with your detail, was shot.
Yes, and you know, we were operating what we're calling a parabolic mic. That was when we did locate a Hezbollah resident safe house that we decided to target. We set up this mic and we were basically listening to conversations through walls, and it became fairly clear that somebody was watching us, watching Hezbollah, and then subsequently one of our teammates was driving just slightly outside of town and was ambushed, and she was shot. She did survive, but it became clear that we were unable to separate what actually happened there and whether the operation had been compromised or not, and we eventually had to close it down.
But as you mentioned in the book, though, that an operation that ends with somebody getting shot is an example of a failed operation, that the whole purpose of what you and your husband did in the CIA was that nobody knew about it, and that contrary to what we see in James Bond movies, where it's all about guns and assassination and car chases, the opposite is true in the real world.
No, you never want to be seen in espionage. You'll notice with MI6, you never see their name plastered across the newspapers unless there's been some sort of horrible failure, like a mole, like, you know, the Cambridge Five. The whole idea of espionage is to be able to do it quietly, legally as well, in the sense of you don't want to be breaking your own national laws. And so, like, when we see this finding, covert action finding, published in the papers last week about Libya, that is a failure by definition, because, you know, we don't want the world to know that we're backing one side in Libya at this point, other than a no-fly zone. So yes, it was a failure, and in this book we talk about, you know, this constant attempt to disappear overseas.
Well, but you also talk about in the book, when you talk about moles, one of the great tragedies there is that your friend that you befriended in the boondocks of Tajikistan, the KGB guy that was there that you tried to win over, when you finally got him to come to the United States and they gave him the full-on tour of the United States, and even going to set up his two daughters at Clemson College because they wanted to be educated in the United States, that in the final briefing at the CIA, one of the briefers that joined the team was Aldrich Ames, the double agent. And, of course, his last act before he was arrested was to give up your friend whose life and career was destroyed. And, you know, Ames' first act was to give up Oleg Gordievsky, the valuable double agent the Brits had. And his last act was to give up your friend. But at the same time, the CIA knew that at that point that Ames was working for the other side. It's almost incomprehensible.
Well, it's this whole idea of betrayal. I mean, you know, I was me and this KGB officer were throwaways in this operation. What was happening at the time was that Ames was closer to being arrested, and the FBI came to the CIA and said, "We'll do anything to keep him thinking that he's not under suspicion." One way to do that was to introduce him to sensitive cases, which was one of mine. Ames knew that I was attempting to recruit this KGB officer. And they also had told Ames about the same time that he was going to take over Russia House. And what they were doing in this was giving the Russians some baits. You know, there was no way that the Russians could, you know, pull him out and take him to Moscow. What was everybody was afraid of was there was another mole besides Ames who would find out about the investigation it's all spy versus spy. It's a very gray area. But what that told me, the lesson was that just as I had sacrificed people in my career in espionage, I got sacrificed.
Well, you also got hung out to dry because I think, again, the audience would find it almost incomprehensible that you had been in contact with a group of Iraqi generals who were intent upon a coup against Saddam Hussein. They had a plan to surround his villa in Tikrit with tanks. It was all it looked like it was going to work. The CIA got cold feet. And then the FBI came after you for violating the assassination of foreign leaders statute. So that's in itself incomprehensible, given the fact that what happened later to get rid of Saddam, the Iraq War, was such a tragedy.
But yeah, this is a very personal book because what you do is you see both Dana and me as coming in fairly young, fairly naive. And figuring out through this book the way the world works, and it's fairly brutal. I mean, right. In Iraq, when this coup was going down, I was sending a message every day, saying this is what they plan to do, this is how they're going to do it. What is your position in Washington? And never got an answer. And then once it went bad, of course, they sent the FBI after me and my team.
And just in closing, then, with Dana, let me ask Dana about the other great tragedy in the story, which is the two friends that you both had, Marwan and Malik, both Iraqis, and you were going to go in together, you and Bob, for ABC News in before the last Iraq War, before Operation Iraqi Freedom, as it's called, and. The Malik was helping you get in, and lo and behold, he gets hit by 6 cruise missiles, and his entire family gets wiped out.
Yes, it was. You know, I think the biggest sadness in our life so far. And just they were going to help us go in. We were going to, for ABC News, we were going to record the reactions to Saddam's fall and stay in the Western Desert in their compound. And we had met with them in Jordan just in the lead up to the war, and. They were recruiting some Bedouin to take us across the border, and just before we were ready to go, we got notice that the compound had been hit by 6 American JDAM missiles, and Malik was killed, and all the women and children who had been gathered in a separate house for the evening were killed. So yes, it was a very serious and sad wake-up call for us.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank both of you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Robin Dana Bear.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robin Dana Bear, authors of a new book, The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife, True Life Spy Story. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. If you heard something you like, something that you don't like, any suggestions or tips, let us know. We read every email. You can also check out my blog at ianmasters.com. Click on blog. Bye for now.